Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight number 300 for comics originally released on May 8th, 2013. Now, starting us off in DC is Batman and Robin, or actually, it was solicited as Batman and Robin 20. It came out as Batman and Red Hood number 20. I'm actually a little curious with this whole rotating through guest stars right now of this title, which had started as Batman and Robin. And then last issue, I believe, was Batman and Red Robin. Next issue will be Batman and Batgirl, then Batman and Catwoman, then Batman and Nightwing. I'm curious who they're going to land on as you know, a regular co-feature here. Because otherwise it's just Batman, and we've already got that title. Or if this may turn out to be kind of the you know, current Brave and the Bold sort of a thing, where it's just a rotating Batman team-up.
Mm-hmm.
Which could be kind of fun.
Yeah, the Indicia for this one says Batman and Red Hood, paren Batman and Robin, number 20. So, that's kind of interesting. It'll end up in the databases. Is it going to just be... It's kind of like what they did with Captain America and Bucky.
Yeah, you which know, then was Captain America and Falcon, Captain America and Black Widow, and whoever else. Iron Man.
Iron Man, and yeah.
Yeah, those sorts of things always drive me nuts because, you know, in addition to how do they land in the database, how they get solicited, how they get shipped, and how they get put on the top sellers list is different.
And so it makes it hard with your issue-to-issue comparisons.
Yeah, just tying all that data together gets challenging. And this is the sort of thing that, you know, a lot of stores will probably just put it under Batman and stuff in the back issue racks. But, you know, as years go by and newer people come into places like, you know, be it a MyComicShop.com, a Mile High Comics, or some of these other back issue dealers, and become, you know, as time goes on, less familiar with what had happened with the title, it's more likely to get just kind of confused in those databases and those things. You know, is that a big deal to the current creators and publishers? Obviously not. Should it be? Maybe. We'll deal with that as time goes on. It's not the first time this sort of thing has happened, and it undoubtedly will not be the last. A couple of things stood out for me in this issue. I mean, the whole point of this story arc is, I mean, we got a much darker Batman than usual, and given recent events with Damian, that makes a lot of sense. And kind of the whole point of the story arc is Batman going through the five stages of grief. You know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, and stuff like that. And, you know, it's an kind of an obvious storyline to go through. It's interesting. But they're making some choices here in terms of what they're setting up and what they're resetting up in a few cases that I'm not sure where they're going. You know, they've introduced Carrie Kelly in the previous issue. She gets five pages here, setting her up more and establishing her as a potentially recurring character. And, you know, obviously this is the character that became Robin in The Dark Knight, the original miniseries back in the day. And, you know, I think they're teasing, will she become the new Robin, will she not? It's interesting, I'm liking this version of the character, but it seems a little redundant to what they've done with Harper Row over in Batman. You know, another young female who's a potential, you know, sidekick kind of a character or whatever. So having those two story arcs kind of going on in parallel seems a little odd to me. It also seemed strange to me that Jason is, you know, I believe lying to Batman as to how he came back from the dead. And this is one of those things with, you know, post-Flashpoint, they're playing a little fast and loose as to what had happened before that they're keeping and what had happened before that they're not keeping. And I'm going on the presumption that Jason was resurrected by Talia, presumably with a Lazarus Pit and stuff, kind of like he was pre-Flashpoint, kind of hoping they're sweeping a few things under the rug, like that whole hypertime punch with Superboy Prime, you know, re-altering reality and letting that happen, and maybe they'll just conveniently ignore that. But this issue actually did a much better job for me selling why the Red Hood doesn't and frankly shouldn't trust Batman much more so than Death of the Family did. I mean, what were your thoughts on that?
You know, I read through the issue, and it just didn't feel right to me. And I saw where they were going with it. As you point out, I mean, we're going through the stages of grief. You know, that's even the, you know, this one's called Rage, and the next issue, you know, is called The Bargain. So that's bargaining and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But as I was reading it, Batman's dialogue and his whole attitude, it didn't feel right to me. It felt forced.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when you read it, if you kind of felt the same way, but it just didn't flow for me as I was reading the issue, and it took me out of the story to some extent.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because we've got three main characters in this issue: Batman, Red Hood, and to a lesser degree, Carrie Kelly. Now let's ignore her, because she was kind of in that five page separate thing. But I think this didn't flow, both for Batman, like you mentioned, because it did feel a little forced, almost like he's trying to push his way through those five stages as quickly as possible so he can get back to work or something. But from the Red Hood point of view, this takes place before Red Hood and the Outlaws number 19, which, you know, kind of makes sense, because if what they did at the end of that issue sticks, it's a major status quo change for Jason. But, you know, whether anything sticks these days is a fair question, and a dubious one at that. But this is after the whole attack of that the Joker left him in the hood, from which he bounced back and, you know, like it never happened. I mean, they mention he's recovered from that, he's doing fine, but what I took at the end of one issue, I guess it would have been 17 or 18 or whatever, whatever the first one was right after Death of the Family, it's like, wow, they've just totally, you know, changed the status quo for Jason. No, just kidding. Now they've, in the Red Hood and the Outlaws, done that again, and it's like, well, are they kidding, or did they do the first one to fake me out so I wouldn't buy this one, you know? There comes a point where a little more straightforward storytelling and actually having some repercussions and making things a little bit more believable or whatever would really help them out. And I think those sorts of things, for me, undercut the emotional core of what they were trying to do here. Particularly, you know, it's like, okay, you know, Damian has died. Let's go talk to the Robin that died and came back. I mean, why not just smack us in the face with a 2x4 saying, yeah, this one's not going to stick either? It seems like what they're trying to do and what they've done before and what they're bringing up that they've done before are at such cross purposes as to completely undercut the storyline.
Yeah, and I'm not reading Red Hood and the Outlaws. I dropped that a while back, so I'm not sure what happened at the end of 19. Is that something worth picking up? Was it a good story? Was it a good book? Or was it just something happens and it's... Would you recommend it for people who are not reading it?
That's a good question. I would say it's something that, if it sticks, could be a major change for that character for the better. However, like I just said, they've done a number of things over there that just haven't... Well, not just there, but across the board, that just haven't stuck. I think that the current arc, if you have marginal interest in Red Hood, in Roy Harper, in Starfire and stuff, might be good to sample and try for yourself. Would I really recommend people seek it out and stuff? At this point, I would say not really. I mean, I'm not going to recommend against it either. But it's one of those where they've done enough fake-outs, enough non-lasting repercussions to make me very wary of strongly recommending that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a prime example of that. What had happened right after Death in the Family is he had put on the Red Hood, and there was like an acid attack in there. You know, like they had teased of people losing their faces and stuff. It looked like that was actually going to happen to Jason, you know, forcing him to be, you know, really the Red Hood more full-time or whatever. And as you can see here, where he's looking, you know...
He looks perfectly fine.
Uh-huh. I mean, that undercuts exactly what they're doing.
Well, that was part of my problem with that whole Death of the Family storyline, is they had a lot of things that, you know, ooh, the Joker did this, and the Joker did that kind of things, and then they kind of didn't, you know, none of it seemed to stick particularly. And even the, you know, the end of the whole thing, it just, a lot of it just seemed really forced. That's just me. You know, I was reading it, and it's just like, I was my same problem with this issue. It's like they're telling me this stuff is happening, but I'm reading it, and it doesn't feel like it's naturally happening. It's just not, it doesn't seem organic to me, the way that it's happening. And it was the same thing. I read one of those issues, maybe it was Teen Titans. I think it was, we did a Teen Titans issue.
Yeah, just a week or two back.
You know, it was that same kind of thing where a lot of the personal interactions and, you know, it's like, oh, this came out of Death of the Family, so I'm acting this way because it's a way that I have to act because of that thing. But it seemed forced.
I would agree with that. And the only part that I really bought in this is if these actions happen, and I agree the motivation for them was suspect and questionable, but given what Batman does here and how he is treating Jason, it makes perfect sense why Jason should want nothing to do with Batman at this point. And of course, the whole point of that long arc of the Death of the Family was to establish that, and they failed to do that there. So it's like they've got a game plan that's not a horrible game plan. It's not a great one either. But the execution of it is a little lacking. And speaking of lacking in execution, I don't want to say what happens on the last page, but that last page left me completely puzzled because the location was totally unclear. So the actions had zero context for me. And if it happened at the same place as the previous scene, I'm like, why? How? What's going on? I mean, it was something that was supposed to, I guess, tease and lead into the next issue, yet the execution of this moment or whatever fell so flat for me that it took what was an otherwise, you know, okay issue and left it on a very weak note. You know, it's like, okay, I see this other character or whatever, but again, I'm left wondering what's going on, not why is it going on or anything of the sort. Again, decent ideas, but the execution is muddled.
So, I've got a couple of questions for you about Jason's costume.
Okay.
That you might be able to answer because of your all, you know, kind of all overall kind of view of DC stuff. So, one, the Red Hood itself now looks like it's all like got weird craggy lines all over it instead of being smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And when did that occur? I really dislike this craggy, you know, with the noses. I feel about the same about this as when they stuck the nose on Iron Man's helmet, you know, for a while, way back. That's probably before you even read in comics.
No, I remember it. It was also mentioned in the Iron Man and the Melter thing that just came out last issue. Matter of fact, that was the issue they reprinted, I think.
Yeah, that was around that time.
They're going with the hood being kind of like Iron Man's armor is at times, where it can be hard, it can be soft or whatever, and kind of the best of both worlds or the worst of both worlds. So it is a rigid, you know, ski mask almost. The craggy stuff, I don't recall before. That does seem new. Frankly, I'm surprised he's wearing it at all right after having, you know, his face nearly burned off or whatever in the previous, you know, few days. Because, I mean, he's, at this point, just getting a clean bill of health from Alfred. So, I mean, that just happened. So for him to put not even a facsimile of the hood on, but the actual one is surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of those sorts of things where if you think through the logic of some of this stuff, it I don't want to say falls apart, but it doesn't strengthen, you know.
And then the other one is he's got the big red bat symbol on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something that is just because he's going on a mission here with Batman, or is that, like, now part of his costume?
He's had that the entire run of the Red Hood and the Outlaws.
Okay.
And it's they've actually mentioned that a time or two. You keep trying to get away from Batman's shadow, yet you've got a bat on your chest.
Okay. Because I dropped that book a really long time ago, and it was kind of hazy to me.
The book's had its moments.
That makes sense, though. I'd have that same question. It's like, you know, why do you have that bat on your chest?
So, I mean, for me, this was a very mixed issue. It had some moments I liked. It had some stuff I thought it did well, in terms of, again, selling the broken relationship between Bruce and Jason and stuff. I liked some of what they're doing with Carrie Kelly, although I'm a little puzzled as to why and how much it may be redundant with the Harper Row stuff. But then there were things like that last page, which felt like a non sequitur and stuff. So, I mean, for me, there's grounds of giving it a 4, there's grounds for giving it a 2, in other ways it was average. So I'm going to kind of split the difference and give it the 3, with the caveat that this had a much wider range within the issue than I think a lot of issues do.
I felt somewhat similar, although there was no, for me, no grounds for giving it a 4. I kind of was between a 2 and a 3, but I'm going to give it a 3 pretty much based on the Carrie Kelly pages, which I really liked. I thought the Carrie Kelly pages were well done. Most of the rest of it fell flat for me. And I look forward to seeing what they're going to do with Carrie Kelly.
I was surprised they spent 5 pages on her. I mean, they're definitely setting her up for something.
Well, they better be, right?
Yeah, that's true. Because if they're not, why did they spend 5 pages on this?
Exactly. Exactly.
I got to go on the theory that they're doing it for a reason.
Okay, so next we've got Avengers number 11.
This was a very interesting issue, and I don't think it was a very representative issue. This is essentially a spy story with the Avengers, and frankly a little bit of a lackluster spy story at that. And it wasn't a bad issue, but it had such a different feel than they've really set up for this title since it began. It was way less cosmic than the previous issues. There was a lot of kind of cross-cutting in time, which I felt like it was to quote-unquote keep things interesting, which implied the writer, you know, Jonathan Hickman, who's a very talented writer, it implies he didn't think that a linear storytelling of this story would have really worked as well, and he's frankly probably right. And again, this I don't think this was a bad issue, but it was one that if somebody read this and loved this and then said, ah, I should go read those previous 10 issues, they'd be like, what the heck? This is so different. I'm almost thinking this was more of a secret Avengers story than an Avengers story in some respect, regardless of the characters it had. What were your thoughts on that?
I did get the Secret Avengers vibe off of it. Now, I have not been reading Avengers. I dropped it way back. That whole ex-Nihilo character was not, you know, anyway, that whole cosmic thing and bringing in every... This is the title it's got. Is this the one that's got, like, every kind of D-list hero in the DC universe or in the Marvel universe shoehorned into the Avengers?
Well, yeah, if you go to the 2 title pages and stuff... they've got that
symbols,
iconic
yeah.
graphic and stuff, and they highlight the ones they've got here. Okay. So this issue has Black Widow, Captain Marvel, Spider-Woman, Shang-Chi, Sunspot, and Cannonball.
Yeah. So anyway, I have not been reading this, so I did not have an opinion on whether this was like or not like the previous issues. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, the issues when I was reading it. It did feel a lot like a Secret Avengers issue. I thought that the art was, I don't know if Diodata's style has changed. I was unimpressed by the art. A lot of the facial expressions I thought were extremely weak. His drawing on hands was really taking me out of the story in some of them. And I only mention it because it did actually take me out of the story. The 4 hours ago page.
Got it.
Look at the pinky on her finger.
Mm-hmm.
No one's pinky goes up to only their first knuckle, and then
it's,
like
it's
every
foreshortening,
other...
Bob. It's leaning forward and stuff with the
not
other.
Not that
finger.
Much though. It just looked wrong.
It does look a little deformed and stuff, but I mean, I see what they were trying to do.
I know what he was trying to do,
and he failed
to do foreshortening, but he didn't do it right. You know, it's just like things like that, and some of these. Facial, like on the staple. Go to the staple and look at the second Carol Danvers. You know, it looks like she's like just high or just woke up from a coma or I don't know what. It's just, I don't know. This was an unimpressive issue to me.
Well, I think the art had a certain lifelessness to it.
That's a very good word. That's
surprising.
It was very stiff.
Yeah.
And given that you've got Shang-Chi running around and doing all this kung fu action and things like that, for it to feel very stiff is just... Well, I mean, actually, he didn't do that much kung fu action. I mean, they show him with all these guys around him, and they cut from that scene. So they don't actually show any of the action. I mean, they come back to it, but that's a really bizarre pose he's in. And then, you know.
Well, they intercut that throughout the entire, you know, issue and stuff. So they come back to it a few times earlier and later and stuff. It's interesting because there were aspects of the story that felt like were not quite on the page and stuff. The whole beekeeper helmet on the tuxes and stuff for the AIM agents didn't work for me. I mean, I get what they were trying to do here, but this was another one where the execution was just a little bit off the mark.
Yeah. I mean, I just get to it because I really loved Master of Kung Fu. And when they come back to these scenes where they're having him do the fighting, I mean, a lot of them were just... I mean, there's the one where he's kicking the guy.
Well, how about the one with the nunchucks and he lands and, like, there's an explosion around him somehow?
Just, that was weird. It's just, I look at this in comparison to most of the issues of Master of Kung Fu that were drawn by Gene Day or Paul Gulacy or, you know, something like that, and they had fight sequences. And this just falls well short of my memory of what these things could have been. Anyway, I mean, I will take your word for it that this was not representative of the run, but there was really nothing about this issue that made me say, wow, I need to be reading the Avengers.
Well, and it's funny because I would agree with that with this issue, and it's kind of a no-win situation. People are going to read this, maybe feel that way, and not get it, and it's not representative, or they're going to feel that they liked this issue and then get the next, which is different than this, and, you know, it's like, how is this a win for them in any way, shape, or form? If people like it, they'll be disappointed. They'll not be disappointed, but they will be surprised by the different tone and style of the series itself, for the most part, compared to this issue. And if they didn't like this and they were sampling this, are they going to come back for anything else? I was also disappointed, because this is one of the main times we've really seen, you know, Shang-Chi doing stuff in this title, and he's just such a blatant Bruce Lee knockoff here, and there's really not anything else to him as presented in this issue, that I think they did the character a bit of a disservice in that respect. To me, this was hopefully meant just to be an interlude between the major cosmic action sequences of the main series and stuff. I think they could have positioned it a little better and presented it a little better. To me, this was an average comic. It had some moments. It had some decent stuff. It had some things that were lifeless and unimpressive, but nothing that I thought, oh, gosh, this is just horrible, you know, or to the point of, you know, if there are people who've been liking the title up until then, this is a bump in the road. I don't think it's something that's necessarily a derailing, you know, and throwing tons of people off the book. But, you know, we'll see if that happens. To me, this was a 3 out of 5, and not the strongest of threes. It was just middle-of-the-road material.
Yeah, I mean, going back to our definitions, this gets a 2, which is okay, few problems with execution. I don't know if I'd really go with the "but still worth reading" part, but, I mean, it was a 3 comic on writing. They got pulled down for me by the art, and I really did not care for the art. And it just, I remember when Diodato, he did a big run on Wonder Woman back in the day, didn't he?
Yeah, a couple other titles, yeah.
I mean, his art just seemed to here lack a lot of the, you know, cleanliness and action and life and flow that I remember in Mike Diodato art. This just felt very stiff and lifeless. I like that word that you used for it, because that's an excellent descriptor on just how I felt about the art.
Well, it's interesting because I think this issue was non-representative of both the Avengers title, Diodato's art in general, which is usually much better than this, Hickman's writing, which is usually much better than this. It's like it was a perfect storm of stuff that on paper seemed like it really should have worked in many respects. Not necessarily this plot line or storyline, but overall, Hickman, Diodato, Avengers, how could that go wrong? Well, it kind of sort of did. It's like everything just didn't quite click. Yet I could see with maybe a little more time, a little better editorial influence or something, that this really could have not been changed that much and worked a ton better. You know, to me, this was a very much a swing and a miss, and not off by a mile, but just enough to, it's like, you know, what happened here? But disappointing in that respect.
Yeah. So, let's not seem like I'm not liking anything this week. I had the pleasure of reading Archer and Armstrong number 0.
And that's a good way to put it, because this was a great issue. I mean, it was a great use of a 0 issue, too.
I loved this issue. And it's just, you know, I've been really liking Archer and Armstrong in general. This was a nice change of pace. And as you say, it was an excellent use of a 0 issue, because they had a little pause in the action of, you know, what's going on. And Archer's reading Gilgamesh. And, of course, Armstrong is... you know, going back and like, well, I was there. Let me tell you about this. And it was just really fun how they did the whole story. The story worked really well for me. The art was good. And I liked it as, again, just kind of a change of pace from the current day story, which I think is really strong and I'm loving. But this one, I really liked how you see the brothers kind of working together in this story.
What's interesting is they had already given kind of the origin of the brothers and how Armstrong came to be him, how, you know, the Eternal Warrior came to be him and stuff. So it's like, we've already gotten the origin. Do we need a 0 issue? And this is almost the origin of the origin, if you will, and what led up to what we have seen before, which I thought was great kind of additional layering on the story. The art here was fantastic. The way they used the three brothers was great. I've always loved Ivar, and hope we get to see more of him as he was Time Walker before. We'll see what they do with him here. I'm expecting similar stuff, but they just did a marvelous job fleshing out these characters and revealing more about them in this whole faraway land that they go to. Really kind of reminds me of the place Turok lived. Now, I know they don't have the rights to... I believe they don't have the rights to Turok. But bringing this faraway land in, you know, is an interesting move. If it is indeed the same place that Turok had been, it very well may not be. But it gives it that feel, which I think further fleshes out the whole Valiant universe.
That's a really good point, and I hadn't... I mean, because the dinosaurs and everything, I mean, they can't use Turok explicitly, right? Because I think he's one of those gold key characters. I don't even think I know. He's one of those gold key characters that was part of the original Valiant universe that did not flow through over to this one. So I don't think we'll be seeing the Turok character explicitly, but kind of seeing that lost land and those dinosaurs with... you know, this kind of other take and bringing that corner of the universe into Valiant, even without the Turok character, I think is very interesting. So,
I like how they are, for lack of a better term, kind of reclaiming the Valiant heritage, if you will, and really taking what works and keeping it, taking what didn't work, and frankly, I don't think there was much of that in the old Valiant stuff. But they're making a few minor tweaks here and there. I mean, this Archer is a little different than the one we had seen before, but not radically so. They're keeping the spirit, the intent, and the cool, fun aspects of the old Valiant universes, of which there were at least 2, maybe 3, and really just breathing some new life into it in some great ways. I am constantly impressed with what Valiant's doing these days, and this was no exception.
Now, it was kind of weird. I'm going to use a D&D term here, but it looks like on riding these dinosaurs, the couple of driders, which are kind of dark elf spider centaurs with kind of like scorpion tails. You know, they're a D&D monster from old D&D, but those are kind of weird, huh? We haven't seen that. They almost look like they've got cybernetic legs or something like that.
Some of these characters,
two-page splash.
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about. And there's also the guy on the lead dinosaur with, like, right, the tentacles coming out where his mouth should be.
Right. He looks a lot like, you know, maybe one of the kind of classic spider aliens from Exo, a little with the addition of the tentacles, but you know, those guys had kind of a look,
yeah,
sort of similar.
I'm willing to bet, if my memory was better, if we dug through some of the older Valiant stuff, these characters would feel very much at home in those, if not having been taken out of those. In other words, it may be stuff that Valiant had added to the Turok or related mythos and therefore owned and was able to keep.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if so, is awesome. I think that's a smart move and stuff. And it's also something that's just kind of a cool visual. You know, people riding dinosaurs as, you know, if horseback or something like that. I'm curious where the framing sequence, when that takes place, because it takes place in Las Vegas, just down the strip from the, looks like the Luxor Hotel there. And given what's going on in Vegas right now with the Harbinger Wars, that could put these characters kind of smack in the middle of some of that action, potentially. And then what we've got going on, you know, elsewhere in the backup feature here is implying that, you know, there's more to Archer's history than we've learned so far. So I'm wondering if they're going to start, you know, tying the seeds of, or different aspects of the universe together a bit tighter. We've already heard they're planning on doing a Unity storyline down the road in the not-too-distant future.
I'll be really curious to see that. I mean, the first Unity was so good, and then kind of that second Unity was not really.
Well, it was so definitive, though, because yeah. Unity 2000, that marked the end of that Valiant run. It got halfway through.
I'm very hopeful, because, I mean, everything that they've done so far with this new Valiant has been, I've liked it so much, and I think they've done such a good job of it that it's very gutsy, I guess, on their part, going to the Unity well, because it has that cachet, and if they do it right, I mean, that's the, you know.
Well, it's got that cachet.
And I have every reason to expect that they will.
It's got that cachet, and it's got that taint.
Yeah.
It's one of those that, I mean, they are so embracing of their history, both good and bad, and making the best out of all of it, that, like you said, definitely a gutsy move, but one that I have faith that they will leverage in the best of all possible ways. What I would kind of almost hope to see out of that is glimpses of what can be, not necessarily what will be, of this Valiant universe. I don't want to see them expand into, you know, a dozen or two titles or whatever, but there's so many other characters of the Valiant lineup that I want to see, that I'm hoping they can find a way to stay kind of small, agile, and focused and stuff, yet leverage the big library of material and characters and interesting concepts that they've got. The other thing that struck me with this issue is the whole thing was basically a telling of a tale. And this is something that, when you get this kind of a narrated tale, could very much wind up being either predictable or overly captioned, or you're being told the story, not shown the story. Mm-hmm. And they didn't fall into that at all. This so quickly got into the, oh, well, we're just experiencing the tale as it unfolds, as if it's told kind of live or something. And I was really pleased with that aspect of this story, because it's not until the end, it's like, oh yeah, we've got a framing sequence in the present day or whatever. Again, a lot of what they're doing is so easy to get just kind of sucked into the story and stuff. That's what's going to keep this Valiant universe around, is it's very solid storytelling and very gripping and engaging issues, stories, and techniques that they're using.
Yeah, Ben Lente's a really good writer. You know, he's done a lot of good stuff, and he shows here the craft. As you point out, when you tell a flashback story and it feels like you're in the moment and it doesn't totally feel like it's something being told to you, that's a good thing. And that's mm-hmm. when it's done right. And, you know, you've seen it done, we've both seen it done both kinds of ways in the past, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It's like these things stand out when they're done right. You know, that's the thing. Maybe if they were done right more frequently, they wouldn't be as, you know, like, oh, that was refreshing.
What I liked is the framing sequence itself which was just, you know, a page or two at the beginning and end, particularly at the end, I thought added a level of depth and character to one of them that really just was a nice touch. It was something that, you know, it's like, okay, we've told the story, let's move on or whatever. They could have just left it at that, but to put a little bit of a spin there and kind of explain some of what's going on between the tale that was told and the telling of the tale, if you will, I thought was really fun. And I can't recommend the Valiant stuff highly enough. They're just doing some great work. To me, this was a 5 out of 5. It was great stuff.
Same here. I mean, this is definitely one of my top 10 comics out of everything I'm reading. It kind of pops around, but, you know, it's right up there. And, you know, probably even top 5. You know, this series and Harbinger of the Valiant ones are my two favorites right now, which, as I always have to qualify, you know, it's just like, and that's not to knock any of the other Valiant books, because all the Valiant books are really good.
Out of the Valiant ones, I would say this and Bloodshot for me are the top ones.
Bloodshot has been getting better. You know, I with that, especially with the Harbinger Wars crossover, I've been really liking what they've been doing in Bloodshot, so it's slowly creeping up for me, too.
If I had to pick the top one for Valiant, though, for me, it's definitely Archer and Armstrong. I mean, again, I'm loving what they're doing in the other books, but this one has a sense of humor, some fun about it, a good action adventure. When they bring in the brothers and stuff, that adds a fun dynamic. You know, if there are any listeners out there that have not been checking out what Valiant's doing, I believe they're doing some $1 first issues coming up, maybe. I know they did the free comic book day issue and stuff. There's some low-cost ways to check out what they're doing. Definitely worth doing. It's stuff I highly recommend, and I'm sure you do too, Bob.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's something, and I hope most people, when they go to their comic shop, I hope comic shops are carrying this stuff. You know, it's something I have to, like, maybe keep an eye out for when I go to different shops. I mean, the shops that I frequent obviously do, because I typically go to shops that carry a good selection of books. But when I travel around and go to different ones, I know that there's lots of things, like, you know, Boom Studios gets the short end sometimes, as to, you know, things like Aspen and, you know, a lot of the smaller publishers. They just aren't carried by shops that tend to focus on the big two.
Well, I think the way the math works out, I mean, you're going to put the effort where the money is, and most of the money coming in is going to be Marvel and DC, for right or wrong. But I think there is that, you know, next level, the other premier publishers, you know, Image, Dark Horse, IDW. But then I think in the back half, there's certainly those couple of publishers, Boom, Dynamite, and I would certainly put Valiant in this mix, that have got a strong lineup that, you know, this is something the stores, you know, if they're not carrying these couple of publishers, really ought to stop and think about why they're not, and if they could and if they should.
Well, it's like that chicken and egg thing. And I can, you know, I can always appreciate that you want to put your dollars behind the things that you think is going to make the most profit for you. But at the same time, when something new comes along that's really good, you know, sometimes you have to help push it. You have to actually sell as opposed to offer for sale.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how you build a business. And that's, you know, it's just like, if a customer never sees the book, well, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that Marvel and DC are going to sell tremendously well for your store, because that's the only thing you put on the shelves. When something like Valiant comes along, that actually, I think, more so than some of the other indie stuff, is in a place where it is it's different, but it's similar enough that it's in a really good sweet spot for people who like the superhero action, can pick these books up and kind of enjoy them, you know, right out of the gate, as opposed to in more of a shifting gears kind of mode with some of the indie stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that they're very complementary, audience-wise and enjoyment-wise, to the majority of people who are going into these shops. So if they are featured and pushed and, you know, like you were saying, I think you've said this in the past, that you go to the shop and you'd have, when you had a good shop, they would say, oh, you're not getting this, but based on what I see you're buying, I think you would enjoy this one. You know, give it a try.
I mean, to me, that's not the differentiator between a shop and a good shop. That's the differentiator between a good shop and a great shop. And I've been in a couple, a very few, though, that have done that. And, you know, Comic Gallery in Mira Mesa, back when it existed, one of the guys there, Joe, just had a gift for, at least, I don't know if he could do it for everybody. He certainly did it for me, though. I was reading everything under the sun. So there was a lot of data points, but that almost hurts versus helps in terms of recommending stuff for me. Because 50-50, it's like, yeah, I got that already. But he was able to pick out a ton of things I liked. And, you know, I go back to, and Chris and I talked about this on the trades episode recently, you know, with how IDW is doing with, like, Doctor Who and Star Trek and some of that kind of stuff. There's a wider audience for a lot of these comics than they're hitting right now. And the people at the stores, they're the frontline marketers and the people who, if you can get the right people there or train the people that are there to figure out how to do this, look at what they're getting and say, ah, if you like this, you might also like this other thing. And that's not an easy thing to have. It's rare, but man, the power of that is amazing. And it may be that Valiant's next success move or whatever that gets them to that next level is helping stores either in that area of, you know, if people like these, they will like Archer and Armstrong. If they like this, they'll like Bloodshot or, you know, whatever. Or simply just getting their books into more stores. Because I think a lot of people who like Wolverine or the Punisher would like Bloodshot. You know, I think there's just such a bigger market for, and really in both directions, people who like Bloodshot and who may not have seen some of the Marvel characters through some unfathomable, you know, chain of events. You know, we could bump sales in that direction too. It's something where so few parts of the industry are geared towards actually successfully selling people on titles, getting that matchmaking happening to really bump up sales. That, to me, that's what could make a quantum difference in for Valiant, is tapping into that, because I think they've got the goods, and if people try their stuff, they'll stay with it.
Yeah, and, you know, not every book, not everyone's going to like every book. I mean, we both obviously love all the things from Valiant, but, I mean, there's people on the forum that, you know, some of them will say, you know, I like these titles, but I don't really care for Archer and Armstrong, or I like these ones over here, but I don't really care for Shadow Man, or we're not picking on those books, right, because we both love Archer and Armstrong, but there are some people who aren't going to like Archer and Armstrong. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other ones, because there is, I think, a good range of variety in even the small set of offerings that Valiant currently has. They're hitting a lot of different flavors and feels, although they're all, to me, very good, high-quality type of thing with good pairings of writing and art. You know, some are going to click more with some people than others. So, you know, give these things a try. And you're not going to regret it, because there's something out there, you know, that they're really doing a good job.
Yeah. So what else did you read this week?
Pretty much nothing. I was gearing up for my Guinness thing. I was very focused on that this week.
So what was the final count on that?
Final count was 89,613.
That's quite a few.
And I did get some right at the last minute under the wire that I will read, because they're very cool books and I had missed them over the years, but I haven't had a chance to read them yet. I now have a very substantial to-read pile, but there was a comic shop going, they were on Comic Collector Live that I've been buying from for a while, and I don't think they're going out of business as much as they're not going to be offering their stuff on Comic Collector Live anymore. And they're going to maybe focus more on local business or something. And they were having a huge blowout sale. And they had all these books for anywhere between 15 cents and, you know, 50, 75 cents a piece.
Wow.
And I bought a lot of books that I didn't have. And, you know, some cool stuff that I really want to check out. I remember I had gotten a couple issues. Remember Triumphant Comics or Triumph Comics. They had the serial numbered comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I've got a bunch of those.
I had gotten issues of those back when in the 90s, but I didn't have all of them. They had all the ones I didn't have. You know, so I got like 20 or, 30, of those. And anyway, I mean, I just kind of went crazy and I was going through and I was buying. That's one example, but, lots of other indie stuff. I got a bunch of things that I hadn't checked. A lot of Crow issues that I hadn't checked out over the years from different publishers. And I really liked the original Crow by James O'Barr that came out from Caliber. But then I don't know why I hadn't checked it out before. And there were IDW issues. There were Kitchen Sink issues. There were a whole bunch of issues that I had just never seen before. Anyway, as I was going through and I found all these issues, this was probably back in March that I was making these orders. And they were finally getting around to sending them out. I got in the mail this week 3 long boxes of comics.
Wow.
So Janine and I were like sorting through these things and getting them entered into the database and everything in time for the kind of final count.
I can definitely see where that would keep you busy.
And then also, I've got right now about a short box full in my to read pile just from the last month and a half of DCBS stuff that I've been falling behind because I've been doing a lot of prep for this. And normally I don't put books into the database until I read them, but I got all those in just because I wanted them in the count. They're in a box called the to read box. And then when I actually read them, we'll switch them to the actual box they go in. But, so we got a lot of that stuff. It got all into the database. We were setting up the garage and cleaning up the comic room and everything for the event. And I've got pictures out on the forum. I got some preliminary pictures out on the forum because I was really tired last night, but I threw up a little bit.
I saw those. I appreciated that. That was cool. It's a lot of work, particularly the that pyramid of long boxes you had there.
Yeah, that was Steven's idea. Actually, the guy who was doing I'm going to have a little short film documentary on the thing because I have to have some video to send to Guinness. So that'll go up on YouTube when we get it done, and I'll put a link on the forum when that's ready. But the guy who was filming it for me, he told me, well, you need some kind of sense of scale for this. Make it seem like, it's just like, because most of them are, kind of all neatly tucked away on the racks and in the cabinets that I have. So it's kind of hard to get that sense of scale. So, we built the pyramid and it's taller. I mean, one guy who came was really tall. He was at I did this panel at the Long Beach Comic Expo the week before on building your comics collection. And there were actually quite a few people from that panel who came down because I talked about it at the panel.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a good crowd of, probably about 10 people from that came down to the thing yesterday. In total, I had about 42, 43 people go through.
Cool.
And anyway, this guy was tall, but it was still about an inch or two taller than him. And that was the idea, was to have it be taller than anyone there. And then Janine had the idea, since Guinness, it's all about the numbers, each rack and each place that I keep the comics, we went in the database and these boxes are on this rack. So it's okay. This 30 box rack has whatever,
9,000 and some outer. Yeah. Whatever. I saw those on the pictures.
Right. So you can kind of look as you're walking around. It's like, okay, this number of comics is here. This number of comics is there. So that was kind of fun. It was a good idea. But again, it's something that just took a little doing because you got to we put all the numbers in the spreadsheet and you're kind of totaling it up and printing out the little labels and cutting them out and sticking them up and all that kind of stuff. So
it's the kind of stuff that's not necessarily hard to do, but a bit time consuming.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can understand that. Cool. Couple of things I read that I want to just kind of give some quick mentions to. Got the final issues of Deathstroke, Ravagers, and Team 7. Frankly, not really surprised all of those were ending, and the order of events in some of those versus when they were actually released was a little odd. Because they all kind of dovetailed together in weird ways. And then we got another issue of Demon Knights and Threshold, both of which are fun, but frankly I'm not surprised either of those are ending. A little sad to see both of those go, though. Other one that I really enjoyed was Smallville Season 11, number 13. We're starting kind of a Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes storyline in a very Smallville style, and that's been a lot of fun so far. A couple other things I read and stuff, but those were the big things so far. Katana, there was a mention of the new Creeper that we've seen. What was interesting, and one of the people mentioned this on the forum, that they've got a Creeper one-shot coming soon. We haven't seen it solicited, including the latest round of solicitations, so it's not coming out until, like, September. So
at least, right?
Yeah, at least. So this whole coming soon, very interesting terminology. Don't know that I would agree with that. But, you know, we'll see what direction they go with that character and if the character shows up between now and then. But it almost seemed like they were bouncing him out of that title over to his one-shot, which, you know, we'll see eventually. So, don't know.
Yeah, I've been following that thread and just kind of like, well, it's interesting.
I was expecting the character to show up over in Phantom Stranger.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what they're doing with a couple of these things. And it's funny because... I was, you know, reading my comics, I'm looking at the house ads, and some of what's going on with the house ads for the Green Lantern stuff seems like giving away key story elements for the next major creative teams and arcs and stuff already. So talk about stealing one's thunder, that just seemed a little puzzling to me. And then, of course, the whole Channel 52 stuff continues to sometimes give away more than I feel it should. And I think this is their attempts to try to promote things and get interest going, but it just seems, again, like that's a bit of a lost art these days and more counterproductive than helpful the way they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If we got nothing else, I'd like to kind of thank you for your time and effort you put in over the last 5 or 6 years on the podcast, Bob. You know, I hope you're going to continue to participate in the forum and the comic book page community and stuff going forward, and certainly report back on the whole Guinness thing.
Yeah, thank you, and yeah, I look forward to, you know, if you need someone to come along for a back issue spotlight, you know, whatever, you know where I'm at.
Cool. Sounds good.
And, and thanks everyone for listening over the years. You can shoot me an email, bob@comicbookpage.com.
Cool. Join us next week as Drew and I discuss Nightwing number 20 from DC, Wolverine and the X-Men number 29 from Marvel, and Dream Thief number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.